Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance at the U of I College of Business, and he's been with us before on this show to do this program we do once a month to give people the opportunity to talk about money management, financial planning, and investment issues. Usually, and for a long time here, Dave Sino has been the guest, who's also in the College of Business. And occasionally, when he is not able to do that, Kevin has been good enough to come over and step in and do the same. So here the idea is we can talk in general terms about what's going on with the economy, if that's what you want to do. But also, if you have some specific kind of questions about your own financial situation, and you're trying to think about what you want to do, which way to go, I know that Kevin will help you out. Consider that one set of opinions, one set of ideas. You know, I think on the program before when Dave's been here, I've always said, we don't want you to do something just because one of these guys says to go out and do it. We want you to think very carefully, do a lot of research, do a lot of homework, ask as many different people as you possibly can before you make a decision. But this is one of those places you can go and, you know, sample Kevin's ideas, and I'm sure that he will try and help you out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Good to have you here again.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be here with you.
We were talking just about how we were beginning is that lately, the news about the economy doesn't look real good. I don't know. When was the last time we could have sat here and said the news about the economy looks great? But, you know, this would be one of those times when you look at the news, you look at what's going on, and you just have to say, could things be worse? Are they going to get worse? And then, of course, the next question is, all right, what does that mean to me? What do I do about it?
Right. It's always the case where news is, I won't say slanted, but more obvious when you look to find a story that's intriguing, that you want to read, that you want to dig into. It's usually not the good kinds of stories that we find. And just as a kind of a simple example off the front page of this morning's Wall Street Journal, just the top five bullet point what's news items. Dell reported a 51% drop in earnings. Cigarette makers violated racketeering laws. Ford is looking to close more factories. Merck suffered two setbacks in its Vioxx litigation. Northwest flight attendants are entitled to strike. We could go beneath the fold, but we really
do you want
find,
to?
We don't find a lot of yeah. a lot of balance to that.
Yeah.
And I think to me, every day, I pick up the Wall Street Journal every morning, and as I gaze through those articles, I consciously have to remind myself there are always things that keep us from feeling comfortable, and that's good as long as they don't force us back into a shell. When it comes to money investing, the process of putting money away for your future is a long-term process that needs to be set in accordance with long-term objectives and constraints. And the day-to-day news is important only as a way to see what's going on at the moment. But the emphasis has to be at the moment.
Yeah. Well, certainly I think you and Dave and a lot of other people in the financial planning field have been very consistent in the kind of advice that they have been given, that they have been giving over the years, that people should put money into stocks, that to minimize your risk, the thing that makes most sense is to do that through mutual funds, to put together a package of a number of them. So that means you can be broadly invested in big companies and mid-sized companies and small companies and established ones and new and aggressive ones, and just spread it out. Spread out your investment and your risk, so that if one part of that is not doing well, your hope is that something else will be doing well, and that'll sort of balance it out. And the idea is that you want to be in this for the long haul, and the hope is that you put this together, you put your money into that, you continue to put money in on a regular basis over time. Maybe once a year you look at it and say, "Is this what it should be?" And the rest of the time you forget it. You don't think about it because it's just too much. Most people don't want to be reading the Wall Street Journal every day because there's too much, you know, it gives you heartburn. There's too much bad news. It sounds like, though, really, no, sort of given what you've talked about lately, you wouldn't really suggest anything different from that. It's sort of that same same approach.
It's the same process of diversification. It's a good recipe for a long-term success. those things about an annual checkup are good advice points. And those kinds of annual checkups allow for things like adjustment to personal circumstances that might change, as well as some macro external factors that might be on the horizon. One of the, for instances, I could give you there, we've seen diversification work across a broad selection of asset classes, so stocks, fixed income, bonds, for the lack of a better term, as well as real estate investments. Those types of mixes are the kind of standard three ingredients. Historically, we're a little egocentric in the United States. We tend to think about the United States investment opportunities with our money. And it's not a new process, but it is a process that we need to remind ourselves of often, and that is global opportunities of investment. So here's the for instance that comes into the diversification theme across the globe. In a recent conjecture of where the U.S. economy is going and what things are happening in monetary and fiscal policy both, if a person felt uneasy with the current state of affairs and thought that perhaps the value of the dollar was something that might jeopardize their future retirement monies earning a fair rate of return, there are all sorts of opportunities that we could look across. If it's inflation that's a fear, the Treasury has the TIPS securities now, the Treasuries that are adjusted for levels of inflation. Inflation is not something that we've seen, at least over the past 6 to 8 to 10 years, as having been a problem. But those kinds of problems, again, are coming to the surface with the fear that inflation might get out of hand, as it hasn't been in the past 8 or 10 years. So that's one of the fixed income opportunities. Another of the opportunities in a global sense would be to think of investing in countries where their economies are a democratic form of government and they have an open capitalistic type of system, and the economies themselves may be based more on natural resources like the United States once was 100 or some odd years ago. And we don't have to go very far away to think about countries like that. Just to the north of us, Canada is a classic example. Very well-developed, liquid, active securities markets, a democratic form of government, a capitalistic type of system, and the economy itself is very broadly based on natural resources. If we believe that natural resources are going to be a good long-term investment, then investment in some Canadian-denominated type of assets are not a bad idea either. We could make the same case for Australia, New Zealand, so on and so forth. So I guess the final gloss on the diversification story is let's not forget about the global opportunities. We don't necessarily need to chase emerging markets, quote unquote. That's one of the international aspects that gets a lot of press because some of the outrageously rich returns that those countries from time to time provide investors. Those types of returns are also met with similar types of negative returns or losses.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Others are certainly welcome to give us a call. Kevin Waspy is with us. He's lecturer of finance in the U of I College of Business. This is our regular monthly show, always on Friday, dealing with personal finance and money management. If you have a question, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about IRAs. And I have some literature that says that you can convert some or all of your traditional IRA assets to a Roth IRA. That deferral with standard IRAs can push your required minimum distributions to a very high level, and I'm experiencing that. You can retain control by converting some of your funds each year before these distributions are required. But rules for converting to a Roth IRA are complex. An ongoing Roth conversion program will usually provide the best results. And I would just like you to tell me if you think that's a good idea or a bad idea and why. Two other people have told me it's not a good idea, but I don't understand why.
The good idea or bad idea is probably particular to your circumstance, which might be different from any other single individual circumstances. But let's start in the general first, okay? Converting is a word that I'm really not comfortable with when it talks about traditional IRAs and then Roth IRAs. The word is not a misnomer, but it's a little misleading in my opinion. Basically, when a person takes money from a traditional IRA, they are taking money that is pre-tax money. The money in a traditional IRA has never had income tax attached to it. The money that comes out of that IRA is then subject to income tax. Mm-hmm. Once a person is over age 59 and a half, it's no longer subject to the 10% excise tax, so we can omit that element if we assume the person is above that age.
Yes,
I am. But in a general sense, converting means literally distributing money from that traditional IRA and incurring an income tax penalty in that year. You are able then to put that money into a Roth IRA subject to certain restrictions, some of which are related to income, some of which are related to the amount of money that's actually distributed out of the traditional IRA. But again, in a general sense, you're allowed then to put that money into a Roth IRA. And a Roth IRA was set up from the beginning, 1996, as an after-tax type of retirement account. The after-tax type of retirement account then allows you withdrawals from it that are tax-free. It also allows, under certain circumstances, withdrawals of the earnings, the buildup, the return that you've earned on those monies in the Roth IRA, also to be tax-free. But, you know, even in the general sense, I'm putting a lot of catchphrases in here that are kind of like subject to and subject to and subject to, because it is a very complex area. In a general sense, here's what you're doing. You're paying taxes now as opposed to paying them later.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, that might be good for some very, I would say, small number of individuals who, with traditional IRA and traditional retirement plans, 401k plans, 403b plans, so on and so forth, face minimum distribution rules, meaning at age 70 and a half, Congress tells us we must distribute assets from these accounts at a certain rate.
And it goes up every year.
Well, it goes up each year because it's based on life expectancy. And it is true that the older we live, actuarially, the longer we are expected to live. But that doesn't mean that if I make it to age 90, that I can be expected to live to be 3,000. So the bottom line is, we're kind of facing this forced distribution problem based on an age expectancy. And it's still a process of having to pay taxes when money comes out of those retirement plans, traditional IRAs, 403Bs, 401Ks, so on and so forth. But again, unless the sum of money is a rather large sum of money, and the distribution rules are forcing a person to take the money out in a way that they don't feel is advantageous to them, the bottom line is you're still paying taxes all up front, as opposed to paying taxes over the coming years.
You mean if you take it out and put it into the Roth?
If you, quote-unquote, convert a traditional IRA into a Roth.
Well, I wouldn't do it all at once. I would do it in small amounts.
And that gets to the genesis of the little brochure that you were reading from that advocates basically a staged process, mm-hmm, of paying it out over time and converting it over time into a Roth IRA. And to me, that might have benefits, because one of the less spoken benefits of a Roth IRA has to do with passing assets to the next generation. So it's, I would say it's akin to an estate planning tool. Absent that actual use for the Roth IRA, though, it still boils down to, well, okay, fine. If I'm distributing money from the traditional IRAs and rolling into the Roth IRA, I'm paying my tax.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. let's say the dollars are the same, as if I'm just taking my minimum distributions out of the traditional IRA and paying my tax at the time. So again, unless we're thinking about the potential benefits a Roth IRA has vis-a-vis some estate planning, I would say that it's a very small number of people that benefit from having this planned conversion over time type of process.
Well, that's my point, is that I could take it out and put it into the Roth IRA and my children would never have to pay any tax on it.
Well, and depending upon assets and the structure of your estate, the will, any trust under will, all of those types of things that I would say need the advice of a professional
yeah.
who can see the aspects from a tax law point of view and from a finance point of view. That's the benefit you have in seeking out a good person in a basis of looking at your particular circumstances, literally, and seeing what makes the most sense. But it does boil down to, a very personally tailored type of package.
So there's a lot more complications than one would think.
Well, it's like anything else in life. You and I would love to sit and wonder and remark at the beauty of a lovely sunset. But there's a lot going on in physics, more than just what we're seeing in the western sky.
Right. Well, that's a good analogy. Well, thank you.
All right. Well,
thank you
for the call. Other calls, questions are certainly welcome. Kevin Waspe is our guest. He's a lecturer of finance at the U of I College of Business. This is our monthly show on personal finance. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just going back for a moment to what we were talking about before, what people might want to think about as they think about putting together an investment portfolio. And again, looking at stocks, again, standard advice being, well, you want to be broadly diversified in the kinds of companies you invest in maybe you want to have some in American companies and some in companies in some other country, Asia, Canada, whatever. I think that there are some people who still have this idea that they would like to be in certain sectors of the economy. Now, again, standard advice is for an individual, buying individual stocks, it doesn't make sense. You can't buy enough of them to deal with your risk. So that's why people buy S&P 500, because it invests broadly. But now, having said that, though, I'm sure there are people who think, well, you know, though, there's something that I really think is going to take off. Well, one time, maybe it was high tech and Silicon Valley stocks. Who knows what it is now? You know, maybe you look at the fact that the population of the country is getting older. So maybe you think you'd want to invest in healthcare or nursing homes or something like that, you know. And there are ways that you can do that in mutual funds. So if there is something like that that you just feel this is going to be the next thing, what's your attitude towards doing that kind of investing?
I personally love analyzing companies and buying individual stocks. Much of what I teach is investment analysis and portfolio management. I've got former students that are managers of funds, and that's my bias. It's best summed up in the words, and I'll just paraphrase the words of Benjamin Graham. Graham and Dodd, the two godfathers of securities analysis back in the days of the 1920s, said it better than I could ever imagine saying it. And for the lack of reading the actual quote, let me just say it this way. Ben Graham said a long time ago, if you want to invest, you have to first choose to be an active or a passive investor. An active investor enjoys digging into a company's profile, digging into the company's financials, and then making educated guesses. A passive investor doesn't have the time or desire to do that. And Graham, who, again, one of the forerunners in securities analysis, literally analyzing individual companies and making individual investment selections, was the first to say, if that's not your cup of tea, buy a broad-based spectrum and go enjoy the rest of your life. So the bias one has kind of at the beginning sets the stage. I think it's always wise to set a foundation with a broad spectrum investment approach. Call it indexing, mutual funds, for any type of words we'd use to describe it. That's basically the bulk of your investment funding. If you find excitement, if you find entertainment, if you find intrigue in looking at the next, name the name that, you know, doubled, tripled, quadrupled, whatever in value, that's the small amount of money that you do not need to depend upon. That's the small amount of money that can make a big difference if you're right and you've gotten a double, a triple, a quadruple on it. But at the same time, does not affect your standard of living whatsoever if it bombs out and you end up losing everything that goes into it. And I think that's the biggest fallacy many people have in trying to discuss or debate whether they should be an active or a passive investor. One is not necessarily better than another, in my opinion, if you take the approach that you're not going to bet the ranch on any single hunch, analysis, or any other process of deciding which company to buy, which investment to buy. That's how you end up in the poorhouse, by betting the farm on one bet.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Go to another Urbana caller, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In reference to the 401s, is there a table available that determines what the minimum withdrawal would be?
There's no table that determines a dollar amount of minimum withdrawal because it's based on two things. Number one is your age. So there we'd have to look at the actuarial tables. You could do a Google search. You could go to the American Actuarial Society homepage. They'll show you the actuarial tables that the IRS uses. You could even go to the IRS.gov homepage. They show you the actuarial tables used. The other thing that determines the dollar amount of minimum distribution is, of course, the amount of the money that is in pre-tax retirement accounts. So you'd aggregate all of that value at a certain date. Year end is usually when people make that calculation. And then use the life expectancy factor out of the appropriate actuarial table, a simple division, and there you have this year's minimum distribution. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you come up with a percentage of the amount in the 401 that has to be withdrawn then.
Well, you come up with a dollar amount, because if I add up the dollar value of all 401k, IRAs, any pre-tax retirement plan money, and divide by a number, which is a life expectancy measured in years, then I come up with those numbers of dollars that need to be distributed in that current year. Not to complicate matters further, when a person gets to the minimum distribution requirements, they sign a form that basically tells which method they're choosing to do that calculation. It could be a single life expectancy. It could be a joint life expectancy if they have a spouse. It could be a method that allows recalculation annually or a set calculation that carries each year. So again, I mean, the basics are pretty straightforward, but the nuances complicate things quickly.
Yes. Then an explanation of this, the ground rules, would be available on the IRS website or where?
Yeah, the IRS's homepage will take you to distribution requirements for retirement plans. They do have a link on there that gets you to the actuarial tables. The actuarial tables then tell you if I'm 74 years old, as a single life, here's how long I'm expected to live. Isn't that a cheery topic? And if I use that number as a divisor into the $100,000 that I have in all retirement accounts, let's say the life expectancy factor of 10, I've got $100,000 all totaled in retirement funds. Well, then this year my minimum distribution is $100,000 divided by 10, or $10,000.
That sounds simple enough. Theoretically, then, at the end of the life expectancy, it should be a zero account.
In the aggregate, yeah, it should be a zero account. Now, that's what's wonderful about an actuarial table. If we have enough people, we could literally say when one of them is going to reach that life expectancy and expire. Isn't that a polite word? If any individual tries to apply that to themselves, then seldom will they expire in the year, much less on the day that some actuarial table predicts or, how should we say, forecasts that they will.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, at the end of distribution, there's always the catch-up provision. If the person outlives and the value of the account, let's remember, all of the assets still in the retirement account hopefully are still growing. So each year, let's say in our example as we began earlier, let's say we had $100,000, we took our $10,000 minimum distribution, and then for the next year, that $90,000 remaining in the account grew by 15%. We would have more than $100,000 again for the second year's calculation of a distribution if we had chosen the method that says do not recalculate each year. That means that we would take the original factor, 10, reduce it by 1 year to 9, and let's say divide our $112,000 now at the end of the year that the account has grown by a factor of 9, and our distribution has just grown. We're going to get more than our $10,000 distribution in the second year. So you see the factors work against each other to a point of saying, well, in the final analysis, the factor goes down to 1, so the balance in the account is distributed entirely, whatever is remaining. That assumes then that the person gets to that balance by living that long. If they don't, well, then we've got the inheritance issues with the money remaining in the retirement account. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you. Let's talk with somebody in Iowa, Davenport, Iowa, here, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, Kevin, I have a question for you about interest rates. I'm sitting here on a mortgage that's less than 6%, and I saw these deficits, the federal ones, that are as far out as the eye can see, and I had the hypothesis that interest rates would go up and it would pay me to invest that money. But that doesn't seem to be happening to any great degree. And is that because this debt isn't that large a proportion of the GNP or what?
That's, wow, that's a great question. Over an adult beverage, we could discuss this for hours. It's one of my favorite topics. In a nutshell, because we're constrained to some time here, my personal feelings on what's going on in Washington, D.C., as well as most of the state's capitals, is very long-term detrimental to the financial health of our society. Now, I don't want to sound like a doomsayer, but I really feel like this is a bad path, and we've walked it before. So we can make light of the current deficit. We can make light of the current outstanding debt, the technical total outstanding debt, government bonds outstanding, $7 trillion, as a percent of GDP. And that's how we feel good about it. It's not that great a percent of GDP. But in the same vein, here's how I feel bad about it. It doesn't say anything about the contingent liabilities of our federal government, much less our state governments. And here's a contingent liability for you. Have you heard Social Security?
Yes.
That's a big contingent liability. And unless we find a lot of workers real fast, I mean like over the next 20 years, to begin to pay Social Security taxes at the rate we, you and I, that are working still, are paying them, or at a higher rate, we've got a heck of a bill to pay with Social Security alone.
Well, that's right, but why would that have to come from the workers with these huge concentrations
of
wealth at the top? Why can't we tax those people and supplement security that way.
Well, we already are taxing those people. Those people that earn...
We've been cutting their taxes, I thought.
Well, those people that earn an unlimited amount are still paying Social Security taxes on that unlimited amount. The cap on income in terms of Social Security tax was removed years ago.
I realize that, but what I'm saying is tax them additionally to somehow decrease these concentrations of wealth at the very top.
Well, we already have a redistribution of wealth plan in effect. That's Social Security in and of itself, so you want to redistribute more wealth?
Absolutely, because the income differentials are growing, and we're losing our middle class, and I don't see how we can function as the kind of country that we've known for years and years if we eventually concentrate more wealth at the top.
Well, I don't know how we're losing our middle class. I mean, I know what I read. I see the people that are making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. I see the differential between executive pay at major Fortune 500 companies and the rank-and-file workforce. Those things to me are not systematic. They are troubling on a personal company-to-company type of basis. I hate to see companies that engorge the top-tier management team just ridiculously and make phenomenally wealthy people out of, in many cases, boobs, but that's a personal opinion. I don't see that. You know, if I look at the demographics of our country and if I look at the number of people in the income stratas, what I see is more people have climbed out of the lower income stratas into what you and I call the middle income or middle class America as any time in our history. There are some people at the top getting extremely fat. I don't feel comfortable moving to a more socialist form of government or taxation, though, by penalizing those people. I penalize those people by not buying shares of their stock or their company. And I'd much rather take that approach than have the heavy hand of government redistribute more of their wealth to somebody else. I don't like government. That's my bias.
Okay. So how would you sum this up on interest rates then? Most 30-year bondholders don't agree with you that we're going to have problems with this deficit in terms of prices on that 30-year bond.
Well, they may not agree now, but 5 years from now we might tell a different story. So, you know, 5 years now we can have a reunion and another adult beverage and discuss it some more. But in the bottom line, if I'm going to look at preparing myself for a little bit of that, then I'm going to look for opportunity to invest in assets that are not denominated in U.S. dollars. So the mention of things like Canadian, New Zealand, or Australian stocks that are based in a different currency, that are dependent upon a natural resource type of economy, that allow me some diversification away from a U.S. dollar-denominated asset that might be subject to this risk. Am I going to bet the farm on it? No way. Am I going to take that small approach to it? Absolutely.
Tired boy looking to earn some higher interest at some point here.
Well, I mean, in your sense, in terms of looking at a 6% mortgage, you know, if a disciplined investor wants to say, well, I could borrow that money fixed rate long term, 30 years, for instance, and have a little bit of that money exposed to the kinds of opportunities where a decline in the value of the dollar benefit them. That's fine. But again, the bulk of that money ought to be available to pay off the debt, because the best, safest thing to be is, in my opinion, debt-free. I don't prescribe to the philosophy that says if we end up in a circumstance where inflation is a trouble or we see a value of the dollar meltdown, that I should be a net debtor and maximize that debt. I don't prescribe to the Armageddon approach. And that's sort of like, you know, borrow all I can and pay it back with the cheapest dollars possible. That's too much of a bet for me. I'm looking to diversify, not to make bets.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer of finance at U of I College of Business. Once a month on the program, we do the show on personal finance, give people a chance to ask questions about money management strategies. Most of the time, Dave Sinnoh is here as a guest. He's also over there in the College of Business, and every once in a while, though, if Dave can't do it, Kevin comes over and does it. He was also here last month, and we're glad every once in a while to have him come by, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just as a very practical matter, sort of over the short term, you got some money, you're looking for some place to park it, and you want to make money on it. Let us say you want to put that into a certificate of deposit. The question people always have is, okay, how long do I go out? How long do I tie this money up for? Because obviously the longer you're willing to commit it for, the better interest rate they're going to give you. But then, of course, that means, well, you're locked in for a year, year and a half, 2 years, you know, however you far out you're willing to go.
Right. That's a great question. It's one of the favorites that I have. We could go a nice, simple example we get to in a minute, perhaps. But the bottom line is this. Absent any specific need for the money, let's say there's no planned, you know, in 4 years I need to pay this off, so I need the money available. So absent any specific targeted time date, the best thing a person can do with safe money, things like CDs, is to literally break the money, whatever the sum is, into four or five chunks, equal chunks. So, you know, if we've got $5,000, let's break it into five $1,000 chunks. And now you're going to set up what I call a ladder of maturities. A ladder doesn't have you betting. A ladder has you winning. Here's how it works. A fifth of the money goes into a one-year, two-year, three-year, four-year, and a five-year. Every year you get the opportunity to do something, namely renew. But what you do is not renew at the same term. For instance, as a year passes and your one-year CD comes due, do not let it roll over for another year because, remember, you had a two-year CD that now has 1 year to go. What you're going to do is take that maturity amount and put it all, including the interest, into a new five-year CD. You reset the ladder. The ladder of maturities, you can imagine yourself climbing up the rungs of a ladder, and you're resetting the rungs by doing this. Here's what happens. If I can believe that interest rates have three possible paths over time, one is to rise, one is to fall, and one is to stay unchanged, then I'm going to play the odds. I'm going to assume that they're equally likely, a one-third chance they can rise, a one-third chance they can fall, a one-third chance they can stay the same. In a normal interest rate environment, which is a standard type of process, something that we usually have. As you've just mentioned, the longer you pledge your money out in something like a fixed income investment, the higher rate of interest you're paid. There are occasions where we see inverted yield curves where that's not the case. We can discuss that a little later. But the bottom line is this. When you look at the year passing, you're going to renew your lowest paying one-year CD with a new five-year CD and reset the average at a higher level. All of those existing CDs are still paying the same rate, so therefore your average will rise when your one-year CD, the lowest paying, matures, and you go out and you buy a five-year CD with a higher rate. That's in the scenario of no change in interest rates. So even with no change in interest rates, your average earning on the total $5,000 has gone up over the passage of a year. If interest rates continue to stay the same and you continue to renew every year, then you'll end up with a five-year rate on all of your money, with a fifth of it coming due each year. So that's kind of like having your cake and eating it too. Mm-hmm. Bonus round is when interest rates rise. So as you experience a maturity and you go out and you buy a five-year CD, you're buying it not only at a higher rate because it's a five-year CD, but at a higher rate than it was a year ago because interest rates have risen. Those are the two out of three chances you have to win by setting up a ladder to maturities. The chance to lose, quote-unquote, is if interest rates decline so dramatically so that when your one-year CD matures, you go out and buy a five-year CD at a rate lower than the one-year CD that just matured. That's the only time in the ladder structure where you're going to, quote-unquote, lose. And again, if it's equally likely, one-third going up, one-third staying the same, one-third, that's two out of three chances to win by setting up a ladder of maturities. It's a nice, simple little structure.
Yeah. Okay, very good. We have about 10 minutes left in the show with Kevin Wasby. We have a number of other callers. We'll try to get everybody. We'll go first to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi, great show. Thanks for taking my call. I have a macroeconomic question. I feel that raising the minimum wage will increase overall spending in the consumer sector, and I'm just curious about your point of view if you think raising the minimum wage would increase overall wealth or decrease overall wealth. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have to bet on history here. In no time in the history of a minimum wage has a minimum wage or an increase in a minimum wage been a positive to an economy, whether it's been a local economy or the macro economy of the entire country. There was a test balloon in Chicago. An alderman decided that it would be a good thing to have a much higher wage paid to the employees of big box stores that wanted to locate in Chicago. And guess what the big box stores said right off the bat? We're not going to open a store downtown. That didn't create jobs. It had no people making a higher wage. And if it had, what do you think the big box stores would charge for the same item in that store as compared to a store outside the venue of that higher minimum wage? And, you know, if the company wants to make the same margin, the same gross profit margin on the sales of those goods, they're going to charge more for them, and we end up hurting the very people that would be benefited from the big box store opening up in, let's say, an impoverished area. So, I mean, in any attempt in the history of capitalism, when some entity, usually a government, decides that people should make more and therefore conscripts employers to pay them more, it's a negative net. And individually, we can see it punishing people that need entry-level jobs the most. Why come down on the people that can least afford it? That's my premise.
All right. El Paso, Illinois, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a question on the generation skipping tax trust. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, a little.
What are the pros of setting one up and the cons of setting one up?
In certain limited circumstances, they can help minimize taxes. They are very conscriptive. They are very inflexible, and they are very, personally written. They require good legal tax advice. You do not want an amateur setting up this type of estate planning tool.
Okay. That answers my question.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Back to another caller here in Champaign. Next, line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Quick question about Roth. I'm sort of new to these. I started one last year, and over the course of the academic year, I'm a professor up at the U, got a pay raise. And now, what can you tell me about what the maximum income, family income level is for using the Roth? And are there penalties if you accidentally overpay into your Roth? Because we're right on the cusp, I think, of being eligible for a Roth IRA.
Yeah. Absent pulling up the IRS regs, I cannot tell you what the maximum is offhand. You see, a long time ago, I discovered that if I could look something up quickly and easily, that I would not try to memorize it.
Right. Fair enough.
So to that, I'm going to have to just profess my ignorance. When the income tax and contribution limits were indexed for inflation, that just told me point blank, I'm not even going to try to memorize it. I'll just look it up when I need it.
Right. Now, do you know, whatever the limit is there a penalty if you accidentally you put too much money in? I find it hard to actually calculate what my income is.
Right. There is, but you shouldn't really run into a problem because the contribution can be made after you close your fiscal year. I mean, you're obviously going to, even filing for an extension on income tax, you're going to have to come down to a net-net number. My guess would be it's going to be before April 15th, and you wouldn't even need an extension from the contribution aspect into the Roth IRA. So my hopes would be that, you know, at least by April 15th you'd have. But to answer your question, if there are over contributions made to any retirement plan, whether it's a traditional or a Roth, yes, there are requirements that the money be withdrawn, and depending upon how long it takes you to kind of discover that, oops, there might be penalties associated.
Okay. Well, that's a start. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the call. We'll continue. And our next person up would be Matt Toon, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a general question. With a trade deficit approaching $3 trillion, a national debt of $8.4 trillion, do you think there is any chance that the debasing of our money, that it's not going to be worth the paper it's printed on? I just would like to have your general opinion.
I think that's a very great possibility, and that's why I want you to send me all of your money right now.
Well, I've got $57,000 in gold, so evidently I'm putting my my money where my mind is. I'm 67 years old, and I'm worried about my nieces and my grandchildren, so if I croak off, they'll have something to fall back on. But it just terrifies me, sir.
I apologize for making light of it. I'm having fun at your expense, and I shouldn't. I don't want you to send me your money, but I would like to just basically say I share some of your concerns. I do feel uneasy with the fiscal policy of our country. I feel it's a political sellout. What has been, you know, the party of conservatives, quote unquote, having control of the Senate, the House, and the White House, have led us to anything but conservative fiscal policy in this country.
You are completely right. They're going to add almost $3 trillion these 8 years to the national debt. Unbelievable.
At the same time that I am sickened by those facts, I am also remindful that charlatans and boobs have done this in the past. Maybe not to the aggregate numbers that we're seeing today, but my hope is twofold. My hope is, first of all, that the voters of this country see the need to realize that we need to plan for our future. We can't just have everything because it's politically popular. The second thing is, my hope would be that our economy is still as resilient as it's been over its history, meaning that even with these types of roadblocks thrown at it, that we can grow ourselves out of a problem. Now, I think part of that growth is going to require some nurturing. I don't think we can walk away from the field without fertilizing it and leaving it to its own devices, because I think the weeds have a great opportunity to overcome, and we'll end up with a crop that we don't like. So some of those things that we need to talk about, I think, are reforming Social Security, a very politically unpopular topic. Some of the things that I can do individually, or you can do individually for yourself, are to hedge your bets a little bit. You've chosen gold. I've chosen to look at a small amount of my money going into assets that are not U.S. dollar denominated, and are more based on natural resource type of economies of friendly developed nations. So as long as we don't bet the ranch on an Armageddon type of investment strategy, I think it's very prudent of us to consider where we are, how we got here, and how we hopefully can turn the tide on this, because it is not a long-term good systemic circumstance. It is bad. But if we are totally afraid of discussing things like Social Security reform, if we're totally abhorred with somebody suggesting that we, you and I still working, ought to be funding part of our own Social Security benefit with some type of a privatized system. I think we're just sticking our heads in the sand and hoping that the weeds don't overcome us. And that's just bad long-term planning.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We'll try and get real quick one more. Champaign Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, discuss futures contracts. For example, people are complaining in some places fuel at the pump is $3 or $4, yet a few years ago it was about $1, and the future or spot price of oil was about $10. And they should be happy because fuel is only up three times, and oil is up seven or eight times now. Do they get the volume discounts, or did some companies buy enough in the futures market to keep their price down? Thanks.
Well, the chemical engineering behind motor fuels and the supply and demand of them vis-a-vis the feedstock crude oil is kind of a neat thing. I mean, I'm kind of an engineering nerd in a sense of that stuff's always interested me. So, you know, I'm a pretty dull guy. But the bottom line is this. Yeah, crude oil, as we see a price of it measured as West Texas intermediate grade crude oil, the light sweet crude, as it's called, has risen sevenfold. Part of that is because, you know, oil goes into a heck of a lot more than just motor fuels. Every time you pick up an aspirin tablet or every time you, you know, put something in a plastic container, you've touched oil. You didn't put it in your car as a motor fuel. You didn't burn it to heat your home, but you've touched oil. So the demand for the actual base stock has grown with our society and the society of our entire world, much more so than the growth of the demand for motor fuel, believe it or not.
I'm sorry to jump in on we're going to have to stop. I would like to hear the rest of the answer, but I'm not going to be able to let you do it this time around. Maybe on another
day. That's okay.
Our guest, Kevin Wasby, he's lecturer of finance in the U of I College of Business. Thanks very much.
Thank you.